Okay. Well, thank you again. So let me begin by recapping yesterday's talk. So I described this categorical version of GLM, not to be confused with the categorification of GLM. It's the categorical version of Lustig's dot algebra. And a functor from that to the representation category of SLN, which on objects, I didn't write down objects, but on objects takes the sequence K1 KM to a wedge product, sorry, tensor product of fundamental representations. And on morphisms takes EI to a certain map, which is morphism between representations depicted by this picture. So this picture is an example of a web which lives in the spider category, which is a diagrammatic presentation of rep SLN. And this overall, this functor comes from this skew-Howe duality picture. And as I explained last time, this functor allows us to write, to in fact even give a definition of this spider category, to figure out what the relations are in the spider category. So, and then I also explained how we're going to use this on a categorical, to categorify this picture and use this to define categorical knot invariants. So I'm going to do that in a sort of, well, I explained it in sort of in an example, in some sense, involving coherent sheaves. And I'm going to explain it in a more kind of systematic framework right now. So my goal the next little bit will be to introduce this two-category UGLM, this KLR2 category. And explain this two functor between this KLR2 category and a two category of foams, which is a categorification of this spider category. So, and this functor and this foam category were essentially, well, finally defined by Kefalek and Rose, but following work of many other people. So that's what I'll talk about now. So let me begin by explaining about this Kovanov-Lauda-Rukier 2 category. And to motivate it, I'm going to begin by explaining, just, I sort of said this a little bit last time, but let me just remind you. First, let me begin by explaining the notion of categorical SL2 action. So a categorical SL2 action is the following information. It's a sequence of categories. These are kind of, these categories are like the weight spaces of this categorical action. Let me write C of K. And functors E from C of K to C of K plus 2. So just like for representations of SL2, these functors increase the weight by 2 or decrease the weight by 2. Raising and lowering operators. Such that, but there's actually some more information here, but let me just get to such that first. Such that if we take EF restricted to C of K, the kth weight category, this should be isomorphic to FE restricted to CK. So this EF, this F will take you from C of K to C of K minus 2, and E will bring you back up to C of K. This guy should be isomorphic to this plus some amount of copies of the identity functor, namely k copies of the identity functor. That's the identity functor on this k. And this is again true if k is greater than 0, greater than or equal to 0. If k is less than or equal to 0, the same thing, but with the identity on the other side. Now, this seems like a reasonable notion, but the problem is, as we know, usually when we specify this is an isomorphism of functors, usually it's better not to say that there exists an isomorphism of functors, but to implement this isomorphism of functors by some natural transformations. So the way we do it is as follows. We need to implement it. We need maps from EF to FE, and we need maps from EF to many copies of the identity. So the first thing we note is that E and F are biadjoint. They're adjoint functors. That's part of sort of the data, which I didn't really say, but they're actually adjoint, both left and right adjoint to each other. And therefore, this first morphism is the same thing as a map from EE to EE. And all these other maps, morphisms, are just the same thing as maps from E to E. So going back, I guess, to the work of Schwang and Ruke, there is this idea, which is that we should specify this isomorphism by specifying these morphisms and the bijointness. And to specify these morphisms, this one will call, well, they called it T, Schwang and Ruke. I'm going to call it a crossing, which happens to look a little bit like an X, but we'll see why it's a crossing in a second. And this one will be just the first one here will be the identity. The second one will be written as a dot, a line with a dot in it. We'll see why in a few minutes. And similarly, all these higher ones will be written by powers of this dot. So there'll be this dot, and then the dot squared, and then the dot cubed, and so on. So among the data of this categorical two-action will be some natural transformations. Well, one from E to E, and another from E squared to E squared. Again, this one written as a crossing, this one written as a dot, and this one drawn as a crossing. And these natural and plus the information of the bijointness.
E squared, right?
Sorry?
You meant E squared to E squared.
Thank you, yes. Plus the information of the bijointness in such a way that we end up that these that this natural transformations implements this isomorphism. So this sounds a little unwieldy. It's a little unwieldy, but it was kind of codified in this KLR2 category. So let me explain the KLR2 category, and let me jump straight from SL2 to SLM, or as I say in this talk, GLM. So,
just a quick question.
Yeah.
So I know that in general, like an adjoint is unique, but a bi-adjoint is not. There's at least a one factor. But how canonical is it in this case? You said the bi-adjointness data.
The truth is, like, this thing comes in many different versions. In some versions, you fix the jointness data, and some versions, you don't fix it. So.
But they're all the same.
That they're all basically the same. So
they're all actually the same.
They're all actually the same. So I guess the short answer, sorry, the question was the question was how unique is this bijointness data, and I guess the theorems will tell you that it's unique. Okay. So now I'm going to define the KLR2 category, UGLM. The two category. With objects. The objects are just as such sequences, K1, KM, but now just in ZM. Set of objects is ZM. The one morphisms, they're generated by EI from, that's a morphism from this K to K plus alpha I, where this means you add 1 in the ith slot of K and minus 1 in the K plus 1 slot of K, and FI going the opposite direction. And then two morphisms. Generated by, so for any I and J maps from EI, EJ, EJ, EI, and for any I maps from EI squared to IJ, from EI to EI, and also junction maps EI, FI, and any. And vice versa, and modulo some relations. And all this can be pictured in a nice way. So the two morphisms are represented by string diagrams.
If I want to do something analogous to finite dimensional computation, at some point there will be something which is Q by F, right? So when you have these sort of things, EF map from EF to the identity, is that?
It doesn't
prevent
F from playing. I mean, this map's not an isomorphism. The Davinitz question was, if in general, if we're categorifying a finite dimensional representation, we expect to have things killed by F. And he was asking, does this map EI, FI to identity prevent having things killed by F? And I said, no, because the map is not an isomorphism. Okay, so these two morphisms are represented by string diagrams as follows. For example, the following will be a morphism from E1, E2, F1 to E2. So to depict E1, E2, F1, I'm going to look at the bottom here and put an arrow pointing up labeled 1, an arrow pointing up labeled 2, and an arrow pointing down labeled 1. And at the top here, I'm going to have an arrow pointing up labeled 2. And I'm going to do this. Example. So here I've used three different generating two morphism. I've used this crossing here of the one, so E1, E2 goes to E2, E1. Here I've used this adjoint guy, E1, F1 goes to identity. Here I've used this E2 goes to E2 dot morphism. So in this way you can picture this the two morphisms in this two category by these string diagrams. And in a similar way, the local relations, these relations, which I didn't tell you anything about, they can be represented in this diagrammatic framework. So it makes it easier to handle what's going on. Maybe, I don't know, for some reason I wrote down a couple local relations, but here's one. But maybe it's not worth it. Anyway, there's some local relations there. That define this too. Okay, so this was, as I say, basically introduced by Kovanov-Lauda and independently by Ruke. The diagrammatic approach is due to Kovanov-Lauda. And this two categories being the subject of a lot of interest because it has a lot of natural action. So here, let me give you some examples, some actions. This category. So first of all, what do I mean by an action? What I mean by an action is a two functor from this two category to some other two category. The most obvious example that you would put here would be the two category of categories. So that's the two category. The objects are categories, the morphisms are functors, and the two morphisms are natural transformations. If we did that, if we used this two category of categories here, then indeed we would be associating to every sequence, k1 up to kn, some category. We would be associating to all EIs functors, and we'd be associating to these dots and crossings natural transformations, which is like what I mentioned here. So there's lots of natural examples. I won't even. There's so many, I don't think I'll list them all. But let me begin with the one I described last time, so on coherent sheaves. So in this description, I use a let's say, a two category, which I call Kohong. So this is a two category where the objects are varieties. The morphisms between two varieties are coherent, or are objects in the drive category of coherent sheaves on the product. So XY is the drive category of coherent sheaves on the product. And the maybe we need some kind of properties. The composition of such morphisms is defined by convolution of these kernels, and the two morphisms are just morphisms between these kernels. They're the natural morphisms here. And I described last time how one could make such a two-functor. You take the sequence k, you send it to the variety ger k that I mentioned last time. So that was, I'll just remind you quickly. It depends on some n. So this is, for each n, there's such a functor. So take polynomials n inside of a sequence of these guys, Lm, inside of, they're all polynomials, n, and then impose this z of Li is contained in Li minus 1 condition, and the dimension of Li over Li minus 1 is Li, with this kind of flag-like variety. And then Ei here is sent to the functor, or the structure sheaf of this locus Zi I described last time, which was a natural correspondence between two such products. Some other examples. This one goes back to the original work of Kovanov and Lauda. It's sort of, oh, sorry, maybe I want to say one more thing about this thing. You might ask, where does this dot go to? So this should be some two morphism. So some morphism between these kernels, so some comment between these kernels, and it goes to a certain morphism which comes from the sort of obstruction. There's a natural deformation of these varieties. Well, there's a family of deformations of this variety, and this guy goes to sort of the obstruction morphism to deforming this. This object in that family. Here's another example. This goes back to this example is from our work. This example is Kovanov Lauda. Well, maybe also known to Riquet, probably. So this two-functor goes to the two-category where the objects are rings, the morphisms are bimodules, and the two morphisms are maps of bimodules. And it sends the sequence K to the cohomology of a k-step flag variety. So, what I mean, sorry, or an m-step flag variety, and some in c to the k1. Yeah. So I consider flags of subspaces in this vector space k1 up to km, where the jumps are given by this k1 up to km. Sort of closely related to this. Maybe to be a little bit more precise, this is like, for appropriate choice of n anyway, this is a compactification of the cotangent bundle of this guy. And I take k to the cohomology of that space, and then ei goes to a bimodule which comes from a correspondence. And so on. Okay. So this, in some sense, was maybe the original motivation for Kovanov-Lauda when they introduced this two-category. Another well-known example is involving category O. So this going back to work of Bernstein, Franco Kovanov, and then further studied in Doppel and other people. In this framework, we take, UGLM goes to the two category of categories. We take K to a singular block of category O for the Lie algebra SL capital N, where capital N is the sum A1. Oh no, maybe not. Yeah, A1 up to KN. That's right. And then you can say exactly what singular black is. I just didn't. I don't want to make a mistake, but my feeling is it's following singular block. The singular block corresponding to the following crazy weight of this K1 of this capital S L N. I put K1 ones, K2 twos, and so on up to KM m's. So Ben or Katarina will tell me if I'm wrong or not. I mean, there's probably more than one choice.
Row from that.
Okay, yeah. Depends on your normalization of the blocks of category O.
Well, you said weight, so.
That's true. Okay. And then EI goes to a translation folder. So that's an example. I'll briefly mention two more examples. So this example is on modules for, maybe I should mention in some sense the main example before I mention anything else. So this there's an algebra called the KLR algebra, or a sequence of algebras called the KLR algebras, and that corresponds to the algebra of string diagrams, these string diagrams, modular local relations, where you never use this, where all the arrows are always pointing up. You never use this caps or cups. So there's this KLR algebra. Upward pointing string diagrams. And there's a whole bunch of variants on these KLR algebras, which were studied by Ben, among other people. And they're used to, they're sort of the most natural examples of representations of this two category. So I don't really want to go into this in like too much detail because it'll take us, I'm not the expert in the room, and also take us farther afield. But there are these variants called, which I'll call KLR W algebras. So, okay. So this thing acts, the category it acts on are modules for KLR W algebras. So again, this is basically due to Ben Webster following work of Kovanov. Lauda-Ruke, also there's some work of Kashiwara as well in this direction. Anyway, so this is sort of in some sense the like main example, but so we can certainly make it act on this modules for KLR algebras for GLM. And but then there's what I'll, maybe I'll, the thing I actually really want to talk about, which is kind of skew-how dual to this, is that this same UGLM acts on modules for KLRW algebras for the skew-how dual Lie algebra, so for SLM. So you can also make these KLRWs, of course, for SLN, and this thing will act there. And this is in work of Mackay. Whoops. And then finally, the last thing I want to talk about is that this also acts on categories of matrix factorizations. Again, I'm not going to go into any detail about this, but this is in work of Mackay and Yonezawa. And what all these actions have in common, except for number four, basically, because number four is of a sort of different nature, but except for number four, what all these actions have in common is that they all categorify the representation. Well, if you choose things appropriately, set things up right, you'll categorify the representation that we started with. So, all these actions. This representation, wedge, and the end, or perhaps the direct sum over all n, or some variant of that. And therefore, so then we have this theorem which I mentioned last time, basically due to Kadis, Webster, and Kefalek and Rose, that these actions all give rise to knot homology, so to categorical SLN non-invariants. And in fact, they all give rise to the same categorical non-invariants. In fact, the same ones. So I explained sort of last time the basic idea behind how you get the non-invariant. So you associate, you have this categorical GLM action, and then you use the categorical GLM action to define a crossing. So you're interested in, you have your knot and it contains some crossing, and you associate to that this Rickard complex. So this complex of functors defined using this GLM guy. So it looks something like, so if this is happening in the I and I plus first spots, then you use some complex which looks something like EI to something goes to EI to that something plus one, FI. So this crossing is assigned this complex. Okay. And so this is basically the approach taken in the work of Kadis. It's sort of like a little bit ad hoc approach. So in this Kefalek and Rose, they sort of approach the same result, but in a less ad hoc fashion using foams. So that's what I'll explain right now. So the category, this two category of foams is an attempt to categorify the spider category. So it's a category sort of built on top of this spider category. To explain the motivation, maybe I start with going back to the two foams, foam two. So this goes back to basically Barnatan's approach to original Kovanov homology. So he introduced a category, a two-category, where the objects are just integers, positive integers maybe. The one morphisms are planar tangles. Planar tangles just means non-crossing tangles. So here we would have some amount of dots. This is some object, maybe object 3, and here's object 5, and here's an example of a planar tangle. That's an example of a planar tangle, so they're very simple things. And then two morphisms. Are linear combinations of cobordisms between these planar tangles. modulo some relations. But one more information is that these cobordisms are what's called dotted cobordisms. So each component of the cobordism can carry a certain amount of dots. So what's an example? Maybe the simplest example is, so to draw this thing, you have to put your one planar tangle at the bottom here. So here's a planar tangle, just like this. And then you can put up here another planar tangle, sort of like the identity planar tangle. And then there's a saddle cobordism, which goes between them. Maybe I'm not very good at drawing. But hopefully you can picture it. But I won't even try. I know I'm sure there's better people than me than drawing things. So there's a saddle cobordism, which, you know, these guys come together like this, and then gives you a cobordism between them. So that's an example of a two-morphism in this category. And then in this approach to Kovanov homology, the crossing is assigned to associated to a crossing, you assign to it a complex of in over this one two-morphism. So in other words, you assign to it the following thing, well, namely this complex here, where the morphism here is this saddle. And then, more generally, if you have a knot or like a NM tangle, then this will assign to doing this will produce you a complex in NM. So Ham NM is a category, and we produce a complex of objects in that category. So just like here, we have 2-2, there's a 2-2 tangle. This, in particular, a knot is assigned a complex. Zero. And then you get your knot invariant by taking Ham from the trivial object into your complex, and then take its full module. So this works really nicely in this for the usual Kovanov homology. So people for a long time tried to generalize this to define a foam category for higher n. And the first problem you run into, well, is that this foam category has to be built on top of the spider category. So in particular, outside of SL2, we're going to end up with some where you have webs that have actual trivalent vertices. So in SL2 case, there's no actual trivalent vertices. But in general, so foam N, this N foam category, its objects will be, well, as in a lot of this talk, just sequences K1, Km, where these guys all live in the 0 up to N. And maybe you allow them to point upwards and downwards, plus minus. I don't know if I've been very consistent about that. And the one morphisms are just webs, formal linear combinations of webs. So, you know, webs as we've drawn them before. So for example, I'll draw them sort of on the, try to draw it on the bottom or something. So for example, you might have this web like we've seen before. For example, you have a strand labeled 2 splitting into two strands labeled 1. This. One coming in like this. And then you need some two morphisms, which will be some seamed cobordisms between these webs. Maybe I'll attempt a picture here. So, for example, there's also could take the identity web between these two guys, and then the cobordism will look something like this. So the like at any step, well, for a while, you know, it looked like this. This edge will sort of shrink, eventually shrink to nothing, and then start looking like this. Uh-oh. And it was a mistake to try to make a drawing. So if you were to draw this thing will become like this. Okay, that's a very bad picture. But hopefully you get the point. So I have down here this little graph, this thing, white graph. Up here I just have these two straight lines. And in between I have something which is a cobordism but with a seam on it, namely this thing here. Okay, hopefully you can make your own drawing. Okay, so that's the foam category. Of course, in other situations, the difficulty is figuring out what sort of local relations you want to put here. Oh, I never told you there were some local relations here too. Oh, well, I said there were. I didn't tell you what they were. Anyway, there's some local relations. Maybe in this SL2 case, maybe the most exciting is this so-called neck cutting relation. But if you have a cylinder, you can cut it and produce two sides like this. Except one of them will, each of them will carry a dot. So that was an example of a local relation there. So somehow these, when we do this, these webs are without relations. So these local relations these cobordisms have to be strong enough to sort of implement the relations among webs. So there's quite a bit that has to happen here. Now, just as with the spider category, the case n equals 3 was done sort of first by Kovanov. Found the right local relations for the foam 3 and used it to define SL3 knot homology. But the problem of defining the foam N remained open until a few years ago when it was solved using this categorical Skuhau duality. So here's the theorem. Kefalek and Rose. That there is a definition of this foam N, so a way to define these local relations, and a two functor. Between this KLR2 category and the foam N. So let me explain how this two functor looks. So the two functor takes, well, an object just takes this sequence to the sequence, not very interesting. And two on one morphism is also not very interesting. It's what we saw before. It takes, so the one morphisms of this foam guy are just the webs, and we already know how to associate EIs to webs, namely the same picture I drew a few times. And then on two morphisms, so the generating two morphisms of this KLR2 category were this dotted strand Now, a dotted strand is a morphism from EI to EI. So what's annoying about this functor is that it sort of takes objects to things that are one dimension higher. So this is like a one-dimensional picture, and it's going to become a two-dimensional picture. So, but it's not too bad a two-dimensional picture. We just cross this thing with an interval. Again, maybe I'll hard to draw this, but I'm going to cross this thing with an interval and put a dot on the thing. These seamed cobordisms are dotted. And also sort of labeled by the matrices. But just like these webs, the strands in them are labeled by 0 up to n, these seamed cobordisms, the facets of them will be labeled by the same labels. And then the dots are live in some polynomial ring related to the label. We'll try to get into exactly how it works. So the but anyway, this guy EI with the dot here will go. This one is just labeled the one, and we end up with just. So I take the interval cross this thing. So down here I see this picture, and up here I see this picture, and my cobordism is just the identity cobordism, but I put a dot on this. And then this two morphism I have here, an I and a j, and a crossing here. So it's got to be something a bit non-trivial, which I will not attempt to draw. but you can look. Anyway, this is an excellent paper, and you can see lots of excellent pictures in their paper of how these things work. So there's some diagrammatic way, but as I emphasize again, it's a little bit complicated because these diagrams are one dimension sort of higher than these. And so they proved that there's this foam category and this two functor. And moreover, they proved that you can use this and the foam n can be used to give a completely combinatorial or combinatorial / diagrammatic definition. The definition of SLN not homology. So how does it work? Again, in the what I've been saying, you associate to a crossing a complex, this Rickard complex. But in the foam category. So I won't attempt to write it, but just like before I said to a complex, you get to a crossing, you get this complex with the terms of these EIs and FIs. I mean, the terms are compositions of EIs and FIs. You see where those EIs and FIs go, and you see where the morphisms between them go, and you do that all in the foam category. And I mean, it's something, I don't know if it's a lie or something, but it's something a little like I can't imagine that somebody, you know, people for years tried to do this without knowing about skew-how duality. I don't think they would have been able, you know, the only way they did this was by using skew-how duality and then putting it in there. But a posteriori, this foam category can be defined completely combinatorially, like completely diagrammatically combinatorially, and this complex can be defined completely in there, and so you can define this SLN homology without reference to this UGLM or without reference to any of these actions of UGLM. So previously, effectively, the way this not homology was defined was by using one of these actions of UGLM, for example, in coherent sheaves on category O, on matrix factorizations. But in their work, it's sort of defined not using any of those actions, but sort of just using this foam category. And then you can basically, by this theorem that I mentioned, it just follows pretty much for free that all these, because all these different constructions come from actions of UGLM, that the knot homology theories they define are all the same. Okay. I don't really know what time I started. Maybe 20 after? 25 after? Half hour? Okay. Any questions about that? Then I'll start on sort of a new topic. Okay. So what I'll talk about now is an annular version of this story. So in particular, I'm going to go back to my work, going back to this geometry of from the affine Grassmannian, and tell you that the annular version of that. So let me just recall that what we had was we had this basically a two-functor from this thing to this category I'm calling co-cone that associated k to this variety Gerk. Let me now take decategorify this. So when I decategorify, I just get an ordinary functor from this v dot glm to the category I call k column. And I'll be a little bit more precise about this k column now, since I want to use it carefully.
So I can ask a question, sorry.
Yeah.
So this foam N really looks like a category of defects in some topological field theory, right?
Yeah. So David asked, this foam N looks like the category of defects in a topological field theory. And so there's a paper of Kapustin and Rosansky about this, which I have to say I never really read, but I think that there's some connection in this paper of Kapustin and Rosansky. Do you know the paper?
Well, this time we find a four dimensional topological field theory, right? Because you're associating vector spaces to three manifolds, right? So I assume it's a four dimensional. Sorry, it's. No.
Okay.
Nothing to say for now.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't really know the difference.
But I mean, it looks like there are some defects and some axioms about some manipulations of these defects. They can be done on these defects, right?
Well, first, I don't have anything helpful to say. But one historical comment is that, like, this paper that I mentioned of Kapustin-Rosansky is, like, quite old. Like, goes back to shortly, I think, after Kovano's review about SL3, about this SL3 foams. And I don't know any recent work about this foam N and topological field theory, in particular with this.
Perhaps the question is, where would relations like that come from? I mean, how do people build this foam? How do people pick up the axioms of this foam N category?
Davide asked, how do they find the relations in this foam category? Well, as I say, for the foam 2, it was just Bernatan just guessed it as a way of giving kind of thinking about original Kovanov homology, and then Kovanov just guessed it for SL3, but then for SLN, no one knew how to guess it. So no one had any idea how to guess actually the relations until there was this idea of defining them, basically, starting from this relations here. So here, this guy is somehow very rigid. The relations are very easy to while they're also kind of complicated, there's like a bunch of theorems that tell you that no matter how you choose them, you'll be forced to use these relations. So here the relations are kind of very rigid and well understood. And then the idea here is to categorify this functor I talked about before to the spider category, so it can be categorified to this foam category, and basically the relations in the foam category were just defined in such a way so that this two functor makes sense. So they're defined by importing the relations from the KLR2 category.
But if you because this is a categorification not invariance, when you decategorify foam, you could also land on things that look like UQ.
Oh yeah, I've sort of suppressed Q everywhere. Everything has a Q in it.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, like there's always supposed to be Qs here, and here the Q structure is categorified into a grading. So there's Qs like or gradings everywhere. On the categorical level, you don't see much of it. As I said, the only like difference you see by whether you're categorizing the quantum group or just the original thing is this grading. And usually it's easy to add the grading, so it's not a big piece of structure. Any other questions? Okay. Okay, so now I wanted to, I'll have a few minutes. I wanted to briefly explain a little bit more recent work. Yeah?
So this gives you strands which are colored by anti-symmetric power representations.
Yeah.
What about other representations?
So David asked, what about other representations? So I would say that there's, I guess the main approach to other representations has been categorifying these Jones-Wenzel projectors. So people introduced these categorified Jones-Wenzel projector, and therefore they were able to define non-homology for things colored with non-homology for knots colored with other representations. I'm not totally an expert on that procedure, but that's basically the idea. I mean, that was done by Kadis and by other people too. Maybe Rosansky is maybe the main person. Yeah. Of course, in Ben's work, there's like maybe a different way of thinking about it.
But it's the same.
But it's ultimately equivalent.
In this action on the algebras, that twist that Sabin and Lev do is just projection onto the Carton component. Yeah.
So the way they categorify these Jones-Wenzel projectors is via these infinite twists, infinite powers of a.
Is everything still very topological looking like in form N, or does it use structures like these categories, coherence sheaves or matrix factorizations or whatnot?
Very complicated to write it in terms of.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think anyone did it directly in the one sort of slightly different question you might ask and is I sort of mentioned last time is whether you can find this analog of this. Well, you might try to find an analog of a spider category or this foam category for arbitrary representations. And I think that's like impossible, as far as I understand. But slightly simpler is you might try to find an analog for symmetric tensor products of sim representations. And as I mentioned,
a lot of things satisfy you all the time. No, sorry.
You mean Young diagram, right? But that also is hard for the reason I mentioned at the end of my talk last night. And people did somewhat succeed, but it's sort of more difficult. And I don't think anyone has any kind of foam version of that. So the shorter answer is like this kind of purely topological thing only really works for the tensorized experiment. Any further questions? Okay, so now I wanted to go back to this geometry with the coherent sheaves and explain where this annular stuff comes in, because it seems to be an interesting direction. So let's go start by decategorifying what I said last time. So I was going to decategorify to a functor this kcom. Now let me explain what this kcom is. So this guy has objects. Well, as always, some sequences like this. And morphisms defined as follows. I take that K theory, so I'm working with the growth and degroup of these categories, the coherent sheaves here, so I end up with K theory, but I'm going to consider morphisms to be the object support on products. So I'm going to take here for the morphism, I'm going to take the growth and degroup of the K group of equivariant K theory, sorry. SLN cross C star equivariant K theory of fiber products for K cross for K prime over Gr. Let me maybe just explain this again. So Gr K, I'll just remind you, was this flag-like thing starting at some L0. Where the sequence of integers tells you the dimensions of these, that these guys are jumping every time. And this Gr by itself, all for the purpose of this talk, I'll just say it's the set of all subspaces stuck between, sorry, there's an N missing here and here, stuck between polynomials and Lorentz polynomials, which are invariant under Z. And then there's a map from this Gr K to this Gr, which just remembers the last thing in the sequence. So the map takes such a sequence just to the last one. And I take the fiber product. So this guy here is some variety which whose points look like such sequences L0, Lm, L prime, maybe prime, L1 prime, Lm prime. So that's this fiber product. And I take his K theory. And again, the composition in this category is defined by convolution. So by pulling back to the product and so push forward. And so on. That's why I call this category K-com. Category where the operation is convolution, which is an interesting part. So there's so I claim that now that there's a functor like this. And this functor is interesting, but it's not a functor. It's not surjective. Like, it's not surjective on morphisms. So to make it surjective on morphisms, we're going to enhance the left-hand side. And so the way we enhance the left-hand side is by introducing the U dot L GLM. This is like a loop Lie algebra. So this guy will have same objects as before, just this K and M. And now it has morphisms. Well, as before, but it has a new guy, E0, which it has two presentations. One of them, you add a new morphism, E0, which goes, which takes you from K1, Km, to K1 minus 1, K2 up to Km plus. So this guy is sort of responsible for, like, you could say, level 0 representations of the affine Lie algebra. Level 0 weight modulus from the affine Lie algebra. Is what will be functors from this guy, vector spaces. And what's interesting, there's two interesting things. The first thing is that this thing has a functor, just like GLM had a functor to the spider category. This guy has a functor to the, what I call, annular spider category. So this is a category, objects are the same as before, the sequences from 0 to n. But the morphisms in this category are spiders drawn in an annulus or on a cylinder, if you prefer. So they can go like this. Some crazy stuff can happen. So this is the middle of the annulus here. This would be a morphism from some objects here, maybe 1, 2, maybe 1, that's 1, 3, 1, 2, 2. That would be a morphism from 3, 3, 2 to 2, 2, 1. That's an example of a morphism you can make in this annular spider category. So E0, so remember EIs were these little ladders where you just borrowed one, and then E0 would be such a ladder, but it goes around. Like 6E0. So that's the new guy we added to this thing. This guy goes from here. Okay, so there's a functor. And even better for our purposes, there's functors to my kconv. Which moreover factors through this annular spider category. This gross money. I'll put an N here to remember that we're working with this SLNF on gross money, which means that we have sequences up to N. And then the theorem that we proved with Sabin that this gives an equivalence. So this annular spider category exactly describes this K theory of these fiber products in the affine space. So that before we didn't sort of have enough guys, but now we do. So for example, and this goes back to question which Matt asked me yesterday, but he's not here now, but well, I gave him the answer yesterday at lunch, but I'll give the answer to everyone now, is that, for example, in this kconv, we can consider line bundle L, line bundle, let's say, determinant Li mod Li minus 1, so that's a line bundle on this variety for K. And therefore, the class of this line bundle lives in my K theory of for K cross with itself over that Pythagoras money, so that's just the thing itself. And so this equivariant K theory. So that's a morphism. This is an element of N in my kconv of this object. So according to this theorem, there should be some diagram, some annular spider, which maps to it under this equivalence. And that annular web is this annular web. You just take the ith strand out and send them around the circle, crossing these guys under and these guys over. Something like that. You have to interpret this crossings. Once again, the crossings don't a priori make sense in the spider category, but then you can interpret them as this linear combination of webs in the usual way. Depending on their label, you get a length, depends on the length of the linear combination. So this guy is sent to this. I know this is this. And since I have about 1 minute left, I'll just say one last thing. You might ask, what's this annular spider mean from the original representation theory point of view? So we originally had, as I mentioned, the spider category was a diagrammatic guy set up to make an equivalence with the representation category. So webs correspond to maps between them. Maybe I should emphasize, in this annular spider, it's these annular webs with the same local relations as in the spider category. So the local relations are exactly this. And it's actually pretty, it follows pretty easily from this theorem that the annular spider category is equivalent to the following category. It's a subcategory. Oh, subcategory. Of SLN equivariant coherent sheaves on SLN of the form the trivial vector bundle with fiber this wedge product. Sorry, this tensor product of wedge representation. So you take the same tensor product of fundamental representations, that's what you would have been working with here. But now instead, we're going to turn it into a vector bundle on the group SLN. Sorry, just tensor with the structure sheaf. So it becomes a vector bundle on SLN. And I consider it as an object in the category of SLN equivariant coherent sheaves. So a purely algebraic way of saying that is I just take the coordinate ring of SLN, tensor with this thing, regard this whole thing as an SLN representation, where SLN is active in every tensor factor, and regard it also as a representation of the coordinate ring of SLN, and then consider morphisms between such things. And this actually makes sense on the quantum level, too. Once again, I've been suppressing the quantum thing, but here maybe it's worth mentioning, because it's not totally obvious how you do it. But you can do it by introducing this OQ of SLN. On the quantum level, you wouldn't work with this coherent sheaves. You would just work with the category of UQ equivariant OQ, so UQ SLN equivariant OQ SLN modulus. And you would form OQ SLN tensor the same thing, or whatever the quantum version of these representations, and you would work with that thing as a module for both UQSLN and for OQSLN, morphisms between such things. And this annular spider category is equivalent to the full subcategory of these kinds of objects, of these objects in this category. And so as a corollary of the last two theorems, you get sort of to summarize it in a simple statement, which is that you get an equivalence of categories between this OQ SLN mod SLN, that's how I write this category, mod, and zip. And last thing I want to point out before I stop is that this is a statement about SLN, but it may well be true for any G. In fact, we sort of conjectured or asked whether it's true for any G. The proof for SLN heavily uses this spider machinery, uses that both sides are equivalent to this annular spider category. So for arbitrary G, some new method is needed. And the very last thing is that one can consider an annular foam category as well, and that's been studied recently by Kefalek and Rose as well. I hope just by Kefalek and Rose. Maybe by Paul Wedrick as well. Hopefully, maybe someone will correct me. Anyway, that's all. Thank you.
As with last time, we're going to open the floor to.
Okay, any questions from Max Planck?
So, the questions. You guys can see me? Hello.
Hi.
Hey, so does anyone have questions?
Why didn't you turn the laptop around?
It's a little hard. I guess I can in principle point it, but it's good to do this.
Okay.
So if no one does, I have one. What was the intuition behind the idea of using complexes to describe the crossing maps? I think I sort of missed that point.
Well, so on a decategorical level, let me just go back to the very beginning, like, I don't know, Jones polynomial. So this goes back a long time to, I don't know, Kovanov's original work. On the, in the Jones polynomial, you break up your crossing into something like this, a difference between this cup cap thing and a identity thing. So this is back in the, so this is in the Jones polynomial. Well, with some Qs, but again, I'm disregarding the Qs. And I guess when Kovanov tried to categorify this, it was natural to guess that this minus one comes from comes from an Euler characteristic of putting things in an odd degree. So then it's natural to try form a complex which looks like this as a way of categorifying this thing. So in the categorical level, in the Kovanov homology, you turn this difference into this little complex. And then if you have a bigger knot, it becomes a bigger complex because you put together these little complexes. And this is basically the same idea. But then in as I mentioned before, on the decategorical level in the SLN slider, a KL crossing is then written as not just like a single thing, but as a whole sum of such guys. Let me do it like, well, I mean, just for definiteness. So it becomes like this minus this, where you send one back and forth, plus this, where you send the two back and forth. So it becomes like a three-term thing, and more generally, the number of terms will be the minimum of these two numbers, plus one. So that when you categorify it, you get this bigger complex, and this bigger complex was, because these guys are effectively these EIs and FIs. This is like identity, this is like EF, this is like E squared F squared. Then the resulting complex you want to build is actually can be pictured as a complex involving in the KLR2 category and of one morphisms in the KLR2 category. And there was this idea, I guess, going back to Rickert. His name I said, right? I think I didn't write it on the board, so I write it. I guess going back to work on modular representation theory of the symmetric group, I think, some similar context where we built some complexes involving these kinds of things. So this Rickert complexes were introduced by Schwang and Riquet back in their original work on SLT categorification. And they showed that you get such complexes like this. And I think the idea of using them to categorify these crossings of SLN representations, that goes back to my work with Sab and Tony. So I hope that little history explains the intuition.
Yeah, it did help. Something which I think still confuses me is that the you expect the crossing map to be something like a functor between the category you associated to the source and then its twisted version. So in this case, in your pictures, maybe going from like 2-2 to 2-2 on the right-hand side.
Yeah.
So how do these complexes of functors play the job of just a functor?
Yeah, that's kind of the question that that Matt asked yesterday as well, I think. So I think that there's maybe a couple of approaches, but as far as I know, in this work of Kefalik and Rose, they would form this complex of functors would be an object in the category of complexes over 2-2 or whatever. So it would be a kind of formal category of complexes. So that complex would be not, in other words, this crossing would itself not be like a kind of functor, but just the formal kind of complex of complex in that Bohm category, or a complex in this thing. Our work with Sabin and Tony, we actually, because we were working in this triangulated setting, this drive category here in sheaves, then we were able to make sense of this category of complexes, we were able to make sense of this complex of functors as a single functor by taking cones. In fact, we worked not as a complex of functors, but as a complex of sheaves on the product, and then you can form the cones in that complex, in that category of sheaves on the product. So for us, we were able to sort of make sense of this as a single functor, single object. But I think in the other approaches, it's more just a formal complex.
Well, I mean,
maybe Ben has some further comment.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I mean, in this action on the algebras and in my work with Marco, I mean, again, you know, like, it's actually just a bimodule. And it's even an honest bimodule.
Not even
a. This is taking an honest bimodule and writing it as some crazy cone of more complicated things.
That's exactly the same as in our work. It's an honest sheaf. Ben, I don't know if you heard Ben's answer. Can you hear Ben? Or?
I can hear Ben, yeah.
Okay. I won't try summarizing it. I can't hear you anymore.
Sorry, I'm muted because we get a bit of an echo. Yeah. But I think we're good here, and if we have more questions, I'll pull them up in front.
Okay. Any questions of Perimeter?
I have an additional comment.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I would think of this, that actually it's part of the virtue of this Bohm picture that you see the crossing as this complex, right? So somehow in the approaches where you see that crossing is just some natural object, I mean, that's nice, but conservation of trouble kicks in, and that's actually telling you that you hid the difficulty of resolving that complex somewhere else in the calculation, and so something else unpleasant is going to happen.
Yeah.
So like if I were going to try to compute SLM homology by hand, I would prefer to be using this Bohm approach to, you know, actually computing derived tensor products between things. So like it's actually a very good thing that this is somehow actually making it much easier to compute derived tensor products by doing this resolution.
Yeah, so it's safe to say that whenever you write the crossing as a single object, like in my work or in your work, it's actually quite hard to prove that it's an equivalence or that it braids.
Mm.
At least that's true in our work.
Depends what you think of as hard. I mean, I guess
I know you don't.
Just write down the inputs, right?
So I suggest that we move to the break. So I think we're going to try to get this water cooler set back up. And then Sergey will speak at 11:30. So let's thank Joel again.
Thank you.